And of course, our guest is Neil Slade. We're talking about his work in the brain arena, the secret of the dormant brain lab. We'll take your phone calls this hour with him when we come right back. And welcome back with Neil Slade. We'll take your phone calls as well. Neil, with the power of the brain and the amygdala as well, when people are in the groove, when you know you're in that groove, what is it that does it? Is there a part of the brain that does it? What?
Well, that's it. That you tickle your amygdala, okay, and that clicks you out of your 10% reptile brain and into the other 90%, where you've got, you know, your brain has 200 billion neurons in it. And if you add up all the connections of all the, you know, each neuron has maybe between 10 and 50,000 connections with other neurons. If you add up all those connections, the number is staggering. It's as many connections in your brain as there are grains of sand on the planet. Now, when you're clicked backwards in your reptile brain, you're only accessing 10% of the available volume of those connections. If you click forward, you're clicking into the primate brain and frontal lobes. You're getting another, you're getting 10 times as many available connections at your disposal. And that's where your power is. That's brain power by clicking forward. And that's when the problem solving happens. That's when the paranormal stuff happens. Let me give you an example.
All right.
You're into numerology, and you're, what, like a 7, I think?
Yeah, I'm a 7.
You're a 7, okay. My number is a 1, and Julia, my wife, is a 5. And so we decided to get married in January, and she said, well, she started doing the numbers adding up, right? And she said, okay, we'll go Tuesday, and we'll go get our marriage license on Tuesday, right? It was like 3 days later.
I said,
okay, whatever. So we clicked. So before we went, we clicked our amygdala. We did a little ceremony in my living room, and then we headed downtown, and we got our marriage license, and we had a great time. And when we looked at the marriage certificate, it said January 11th, 2011.
Wow.
And the time that was stamped, you know, the machine.
Yeah.
You don't get to pick it. We were married at 11:11 a.m. on January 11th, 2011.
Is that something?
And we even looked at our receipt, you know, because we had to pay our $35, and the number of the receipt was 7-11.
How does that happen?
We clicked our amygdala, and we were at the right place at the right time.
When someone is a psychic vampire, an energy zapper, as I call them, have they had their reptilian side clicked?
Yeah, they're clicked backwards.
Yeah.
They're like a vacuum cleaner. I wrote about that in, you know, that's in my book, and I talk about individuals who are like black holes in space. Anything that gets near them, they just...
Well, I'm getting hit with some fast blasts from some people who are coming in late to the show, and they heard you talk about the techniques, but they got the tail end of it. Want to get through that again?
Sure. It's very simple. I mean, the easiest way to start is imagine you have a feather. Now, first, you got to locate your amygdala, right? You got amygdala in each side of your brain, one for the left hemisphere and one for the right. And the amygdala is located about 1 inch inside each temple. So here's another game. This is a way to tickle your amygdala. Take your thumbs and put a thumb in each ear, and your palm is facing forward. So you look like Mickey Mouse with two big mouse ears, right? Thumbs in the ear, palms face. Now, you take the nasty gesture finger, your middle finger, and place that finger now in the corner, in the side corner of your eye, right? So now it's like you're holding on to your head as if it were, you know, you're pinching your head between your thumb and your ear and your middle finger, which is in the corner of your eye. Now take your index finger and touch the side of your head and then bring the tip of the index finger so it's right in between your other two fingers, right?
Okay.
Got that? And point. Now, 1 inch inside from the tip of your index finger on either side is your amygdala, 1 inch inside, right between your inner ear and your eyeball in that area, all right? That's the target area. Now, you don't have to be exact. You just have to be approximately know where that is. Now, imagine you've got a feather. And whatever your favorite color is, my favorite color is ultramarine French blue. Maybe your Julie's, my wife's color is red. Everybody's got their own favorite. Make your feather that color. And then reach in with the tip of that feather right in through the front of your head and just tickle that little amygdala button. Just tickle, 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 tickle. Do it on one side and then reach in the other side and tickle, 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 tickle. And that's it, right? See, now I just heard you laugh.
I did laugh.
You did laugh. And humor is computed in the frontal lobes. You just tickled your amygdala and you clicked your amygdala forward into your frontal lobe. And your emotion, see, that's your amygdala is an emotional feedback thermometer. When, if you want to know how much of your brain you're using, monitor your emotions, because they're tied to your brain function. If you're bored or you're fearful or if you have anxiety or if you're depressed, negative emotions mean that you have, that your frontal lobes are not on. It means your amygdala is clicked backwards and the only thing that's going is your reptile brain. When you tickle your amygdala and click it forward, then it switches your emotions from negative to positive. And your positive emotions tell you you're using more of your brain, that you're clicked forward. So not only is the amygdala like the thermostat on your wall that controls the temperature of your house, of your brain house, right? The amygdala clicks backward to turn on the reptile brain and clicks forward to turn it on. But it also tells you through your emotions which way you're going. So it has a dual function. So anytime you're feeling negative emotions, just tickle your amygdala, right? You know, and that will start to turn the heat up in your frontal lobes, and that will bring you out of your negative emotions.
All right, back to the phones west of the Rockies, Gary in Corning, California. Hi, Gary. Go ahead.
Thank you, George. Thank you, Neil. I just got to tell you that this could have really interesting ramifications for a kind of remote tickling. You know,
sure.
I mean, if my ex-wife is in one of her angry states and she's going to be ripping me a new belly button, I could just look at her and say, you know what? It's time to tickle your amygdala. just the distraction alone would hold her attention and get that positive thing going. And maybe that would work if we could get all the angry people in the wars and everything with some remote amygdala tickle.
I do believe that you can connect to the brain net. And you can have an effect on other people.
Okay.
You've got to do it for yourself first, okay? But
right.
Then you can cause other people, you can help them.
Yeah.
You can't do it for them, but you can help them to click their amygdala forward.
Right. The second question I had, too, is is there an increase in, would you say, is there, like we have an increase in autism, is there an increase of sociopaths in general, not just like serial killers and stuff, but just sociopathy in general, as a result of the amygdala being malformed or underdeveloped or something?
Well, I think what we have in society is we're facing a lot of challenges. You know, if you have too many rats in a cage, they become very cranky.
Yeah, right?
Right. If there's not enough food in a population of experimental animals, you know, they start to fight.
Right.
And I think the situation in the world is where we have greater populations, we have resources that are being challenged, and so the tendency is for society as a whole to react in the historical way that people react to challenges and threatening situations, and that is to click backwards. So we see more of that. So it's doubly important for brain explorers and people who know how to tickle their amygdala and that they really do this and teach other people how to do that so we can overcome all of these problems. Because we sure can't overcome problems of pollution and war and you know, like the things that happened in Japan. You can't solve that in your reptile brain. You've got to think cooperative intelligence. You've got to think creative intelligence. You've got to think intuition. You've got to turn on those frontal lobes. And that's the only way that we're going to survive on this planet.
Yeah, so true. Thank you very much. Great show, guys.
Okay. Thank you.
Absolutely. Next up, we go to Pottstown, Pennsylvania, east of the Rockies, Gloria. Hi, Gloria.
Yes.
Hi, Gloria.
I've got something I want to tell Neil, and also a question and a comment about that darn feather of his.
Okay.
Okay. Now, first, I want to tell you about this cat I babysit for 5 months.
A cat?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, huh?
Okay.
Okay. Now, this is connected also with your with your animals coming back in a way.
Yes.
Okay. Now, the first week of having him, he jumps up on the bed when I go to bed. He sits at the, sleeps at the foot. And I lift my head up to tell him goodnight. This one night, I lift my head up, and all of a sudden, I see he's on the side of my bed, this big, huge, black Siamese cat. Gorgeous. I looked. I thought, now, you're not baby. Now, I lift my head up more. There's baby. I says, baby, you brought a friend with you. And then I look back over to Siamese cat. That cat looks at me, turns around, looks at me like, it gives me a look like, you're not supposed to see me, you know, it looks sort of like that. And he poops. And that was the last I saw of him.
So you saw the cat, he just vanished.
Yes.
Like the Cheshire next cat.
Time, now, the next time his owner was by, because the, now this was a family of 3, 4, 5. And four of them had to move up 200 miles up the road. And he stayed down here taking care of things down at this end to get things straightened up so he could make the move and the whole family be together, you know. And I asked him next time he came by to, because he bait the cat. I wasn't going to do that. I didn't want to get clawed up. So I asked him about, did you have any cats that passed away? I asked him, I says, well, was any of them black Siamese? He says, yeah, Shadow. I told him, I says, well, Shadow is still with you. Now, I was wondering. Now, I was born gifted. It sounds like your wife and I have a few things in common.
Uh-huh.
Now, is it possible, two things with the spinal lobe, can some of us be born with that already activated? And that, if that is activated in some of us and not all of us, does that have anything to do with us being able to hear the thoughts of animals and see the other side and that type of thing? Because that family, not one of them, ever saw a shadow.
Sure. Yes, I think that's true. I think how you are brought up and how your parents bring you up has a significant effect on your perception and your ability to stay in your frontal lobes. And your frontal lobes are that part of your brain that allows you this extrasensory perception to see things that other people miss. Right? Your frontal lobes allow you to see things outside of yourself, whereas the reptile brain is only concerned with me, 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 right? Reptile brain is very limited vision, where the frontal lobes takes in the whole big picture. So these times when you have this telepathy and this perception of spirits, and in your case of the dead cat, that's because your frontal lobes were open to that kind of thing. And as an educator, because I taught for 30 years, I know that when a student is in fight or flight mode, when they're being defensive, that shuts down their perception. They call it downshifting in education. When a student is being defensive and is clicked backwards, everything shuts down, and they can't absorb information, they can't learn, and so on and so forth. And that's true not only in the schools, but in life in general. So if you're brought up by loving, caring parents who do not raise you with brute force, do not use corporal punishment, who keep you open, then you tend to have more of this ability to experience the kinds of things that you're talking about, perception of spirits, perception of, paranormal types of abilities, and very much connected to the way that your parents bring you up.
Neil, is science continuing to investigate, as we've just found out during these recent studies and surveys and everything else? What's next in science with this?
What's next? I think probably, you know, I think it's a ways off yet, but I think the scientific community will start to investigate the way that people are connected. I would say in a spiritual sense, we were talking about the brain net, how you can know what another person is thinking without communicating with the five senses. What are the mechanisms that allow a person to know things that their senses don't tell them? What is the mechanism for that? And I think that's going to prove to be a very interesting area of study. Here in Denver, very close to where I live, there's a organization called ISSEEM, I-S-S-E-E-M, and it's the International Society for the Study of Subtle Energy. That's pretty close to what it's called. And what they do is they study these unseen forces, and they have a journal that they publish where they talk about scientific laboratory double-blind experiments to prove things like the effect of touch on healing, the effect of imaging, of imagination and visualization on healing and things like that. So I think this is kind of what we are going to see in the future and on the kind of cutting edge of research.
Probably so, Neil. Probably so. We're going to take final calls with you when we come back in a moment. With everything that you've done studying the brain, has there been anything that puzzled you that you had to ask yourself, how does this happen? What's going on?
Oh, boy. Yeah, I think the thing that I've really had to ask myself is, why are we here?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very fundamental question. Life is filled with a lot of suffering, with a lot of challenges. You look at people who are sick, and you have to ask yourself, why is this person healthy, and why is this person sick? What is the justice?
Why does that, why does that happen?
If there is a God, why does God allow wars? I mean, these are questions that have existed from the beginning.
Well, I bet someone who comes down with cancer probably says, why me?
Exactly. And, you know, I, again, not to harp on it, but the loss of my dogs really forced me to think, you know, what is the point of that? What is the point of living if you're faced with these very difficult losses in life and challenges and such and so on and so forth? So that was a big challenge for me to come up with to find the answer to that. And for me, I believe I'm fairly confident that I've got a greater understanding of, you know, what Earth School is all about.
Sure do. Let's come back with some final calls with you, Neil, on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, first hour, the predictions of Dr. Lewis Turi, followed by, of course, remote viewer Ed Dames. On Coast to Coast AM on Thursday, physicist Michio Kaku joins us talking about his latest work called Physics of the Future. And then Friday, well, a little walk on the paranormal side and open lines on Coast to Coast AM. Neil, Cindy from Seattle sends in a text message, would like to know what happens to the brain when a person's in a coma. What happens when they come out of it?
Oh, boy. That's a tough one for me, although one of my best friends did suffer a coma. And all I can tell you is that when he was in a coma, there was nothing there. And when he came out of it, it was, you know, for him, it was normal life. I think that's a question better asked of a neurologist rather than myself, but that's kind of the best I can offer there.
So I'm looking at your book, The Secret of the Dormant Brain Lab.
Yeah.
Who's the person on the cover running?
That's me.
Is that you?
Yeah, that's me when I was 28 years old. And the cover...
What are you holding?
Huh, that's the secret.
Ah.
You see that? That was the actual cabin at the Brain Lab. Lingo built a number of cabins, but that was the cabin that he lived in for most of the last 35 years of his life there.
Are you kidding?
No. That's the actual picture of Lingo's residence.
Look how dilapidated it looks.
Well, it was hand-built, and at that point, it was about 40 years old, and actually, it was weather-tight. He built that particular cabin with the help of some of the juveniles that came up from Juvenile Hall back in Denver. And the door was actually too small for him to stand up and go through because the kids built the door. And after they got finished building the door, he realized they made it for their size. And so it wasn't quite big enough. And it was that was one of the first questions that I had for him because he looked like a giant walking out of a cottage built for the seven dwarves. And he says, oh, the kids built that door. And if you look on the left side of that picture, you can see that was actually facing south, and it was almost pure glass. So the solar glass on the south side was both for solar heat coming in, but also for the view, because that cabin was situated at about, it would be about 9,800 feet in elevation. And it faced Mount Evans and the Continental Divide. So it was a very interesting place. That cabin, I do have pictures of the interior of that cabin. And if there's going to be some links for people who buy the book to access some secret archives on the website, and there'll be pictures of the interior. That cabin was filled from the floor to the ceiling rafters with books. Of all types, philosophy, classical literature, neurology, science. There were metal file cabinets filled with research reports. He had his, of course, his bed and stove in there. So it was the interior was very interesting in that it was just, there was so much interesting material on the inside.
You seem to have fun doing this.
Yeah, it's funny. The question you asked me before the break was, what puzzled me? What do I wonder about? And I finally come to the conclusion that the reason for this whole earthly experience is that we are surfers. We are cosmic surfers. And our job, our challenge in this lifetime is to surf the cosmic wave. Whatever is thrown at us, it's our job, our challenge. The puzzle is how do we stay on our feet? How do we stay on our emotional feet? How do we stay upright spiritually? How do we balance? Our job is to find that balance, regardless of what is thrown at us in the way of challenges. And I think if you take that attitude, life is fun, no matter how dark, how challenging, how little you may have materially, whatever your health may be. If you can just surf that wave that you're on, you'll find satisfaction and happiness. And that's kind of what I try to do.
Good for you. Let's go to Anthony, Bronx, New York. You're up with us. Anthony, get us going here.
Hi, that last comment made me think of Silver Surfer, Marvel Comics. I just want to say a great guest and topic, but the worst thing for my insomnia is giving me an adrenaline rush when I should be snoring. But I had a broad, general, abstract question and then followed by a more practical medical question.
Sure.
And I can ask if you please not disconnect me till I get them out. The first thing is the paradox between the more creative, intelligent sensitive, more complex person, like poets, writers, scientists, musicians, that since time immemorial have been prone to the melancholic temperament and depression. And, you know, that book a few years ago, Emotional Intelligence, these people have been more in this existential malaise and, you know, questioning things. That was the one question. And just examples like Van Gogh, that movie Beautiful Mind, and then even more recently, some even say Michael Jackson. And then the second one was I count myself among these more melancholic creative types, and I wanted to ask if your guest had any kind of feedback regarding ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, also called shock treatment, why it works for some and not for others, and why after all this, these technological developments in so many aspects of the brain, why they still cannot pinpoint how it works and how it doesn't work, and if he had any kind of understanding what parts of the brain this stimulates, and so on and so forth. And just a sidebar, those in the Northeast area, I saw on the subway today in New York, there's an exhibit, a seminar at a museum regarding this topic of the brain and so forth. I didn't get a chance to write down the museum, but if someone can Google it, that seemed like a very informative seminar that they're going to have. Anyway, if you can go ahead and...
Sure. Okay, well, the first part of your question had to do with why does it seem like artists have a more melancholic temperament, and is there a connection? And then you gave an example of Van Gogh, for example. I would beg to differ. I would think that perhaps our attention has been that artists do have this type of, are more prone to depression and so on and so forth. I don't think that's true if you look very deeply. I think if you look at the population as a whole, I would say that artists, as a rule, are happier people because they are involved in creative activities. Because in order to be an artist, you have to be clicked into your frontal lobes. That's where the creativity comes from. It may be a popular notion, and Van Gogh is one example of a person who had some mental difficulties, but their history is filled with artists who are wonderfully happy. You know, I think of John Coltrane, a very spiritual person. My guitar hero is John McLaughlin, a wonderfully happy, joyous person. So I think that's a stereotype, and I don't think it's correct. I think probably if you were to look at the population of a whole, you'd find more depressed people who are working at jobs that they don't enjoy. So I would take exception with that stereotype. The second question, I think, was why don't we know how the brain works? The brain is an infinity machine. We will never know everything about the brain, but in the same way, we will never know everything about a blade of grass or a piece of sand. What we do know, and what Lingo's life was dedicated to, was do we know how to turn on this transcendence phenomenon? Do we know how to control happiness in the brain? And the answer to that is yes, we do know. You focus on the amygdala and you tickle it. So you turn on the most advanced part of your brain, the frontal lobes. And the frontal lobes compute creativity, imagination, cooperation, intuition, and logic. And when you click on that part of your brain, life becomes an endless game with the universe as you surf the cosmic wave. And that's what life is all about. And that's all you really need to know. You don't need to know, you don't need to be a brain surgeon to be able to drive your mental mobile around and keep from crashing it. You just need to know a few basic things, and then your life becomes a playful experience.
What determines drive in people, Neil? The ability to push?
I don't know. I think it's, you know, I would say it's different things for different people. I had just read a big biography by Michael Palin, who was one of the founding members of Monty Python. And he just, you know, reading his story, he just had this natural drive that seemed just to come from nowhere. And as he was successful, that drive took him through his career up to a point. And then at a certain point, he just said, well, you know, I feel like the big push is over. And I think a lot of that drive is genetic. I think some of that drive has to do with, you know, just peer pressure in some instances. I don't know. I don't know that you could pin that down for, you know, in any general sense.
Okay, let's take final calls. Ontario, Canada. Hi, Beverly, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Hi, George. Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Hi, it's very nice to speak to you. Bless your hearts, both of you.
Thank you.
I have a story to tell about my brother, Peter, and I will try and keep it short. On March 17th, he is going in for historical brain surgery. But the past 6 months, he's been to have a SPECT scan done because before that, it was deemed a psychological problem with his brain, and they had given him all kinds of antidepressants, and he threw them down the drain, and he goes, this is not right. I know it's not right, and I'm going to find some way to correct this. Well, my sister knew of Dr. Daniel Amen, and there is a doctor here in Ontario who does a SPECT scan, and he works with prisoners and people who have had trauma to the brain, bipolar 1, 2, and 3, ADD, manic depression, and he said to my brother after the SPECT scan, you have a monster growing in your brain. You're totally normal, and what has saved your life is your frontal lobe, your physical strength, your spirit, your soul, and you need to go see a neurologist. So he's been going through a series of tests now, and he's gone for research MRIs last week. He's finally having his surgery on our lucky leprechaun day, which is my other brother's birthday, and they will be taking out a arachnoid cyst that has been growing in his brain the past 20 years. He's making history. There's only 4 other people in the world that have had this. And
so it was an actual physical growth that was causing these psychological problems for him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
What part of the brain was that in?
It's the amygdala.
Oh.
And the left frontal lobe, and half of his brain has been crushed to the top and back of his head.
Yes. And
totally crushed. His MRI. It's unbelievable. Like I've shown pictures of it on Facebook and my friends,
we've talked about that before from people. We've talked about cases of people who suffer from a hydrocephalus disease, where you could literally shine a light through their skull because their brain is filled with cerebral spinal fluid that was out of control. And there was nothing left but a 1/6 inch layer of cortex. And the rest of it was just missing. But yet these people retain virtually normal function, despite the fact that most of their brain tissue was gone. And what that tells us, again, is this amazing potential within the brain, that even if we lose vast quantities of volume of the brain, it doesn't make any difference because we're only using such a small sliver of our potential to begin with. And these cases like that, and what sounds like your brother has suffered, you know, it sounds like he's retained most of his normal function. you know, in spite of having these other psychological problems. But even though he's missing a huge portion of his brain tissue.
All right, let's see if we can squeeze in one more quick question in Broomfield, Colorado. John, let's get you in before we got to run. Go ahead.
That's a neighbor of mine. You're right up the street. In Broomfield.
It's an honor to talk to you, George and Neil.
Thanks.
And actually, after listening to you, I'll preface my question by saying this. My mom actually died about 9 months ago from stage 4 cancer. And the strange part of it was, right before she died, I hadn't seen her for about 3 weeks, and my sister and dad were always very diligent in going to see her, and I had this sense to go see her. And right before she died, one of her best friends just sent an email to my dad saying that he could sense her presence fading. He had this weird dream about her passing.
Mm.
What is it about the dream state that allows the brain to do what it does, Neil? 30 seconds left.
When you are asleep, your defense mechanisms, your survival mechanisms are put on hold, and your defenses are lowered. You feel safe while you're sleeping. You're not concerned with protecting yourself. And so the reptile brain goes on pause. And that allows more information to come in through that frontal lobe area, and you become more sensitive to information that normally is blocked by your reptile fight-or-flight response. And that's why dreams are so important.
Super. The name of the book, The Secret of the Dormant Brain Lab by Neil Slade. Neil, thanks so much. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Tim Banal, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.